Welcome to New Books in Secularism. My name is Annie Sapukaya, and today we are talking to John Loftus, author of The Outsider Test for Faith, How to Know Which Religion is True. John is a former Christian minister and apologist with a Master's of Divinity, and Master's of Theology degrees in philosophy, theology, and the philosophy of religion from Lincoln Christian Seminary and Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. While in school, John majored under Dr. William Lane Craig, the infamous leading evangelical apologist and debater. John also studied in a PhD program at Marquette University for a year and a half in the area of theology and ethics. John has written several books, including Why I Became an Atheist, A Former Preacher Rejects Christianity, and the one we're talking about today, The Outsider Test for Faith, How to Decide Which Religion is True, both published by Prometheus Books. He has also edited two other books, The Christian Delusion, Why Faith Fails, and The End of Christianity, and co-written a debate book with Dr. Randall Rouser titled God or Godless, to be published in 2013 by Baker Books. We are here today at New Books in Secularism talking to John W. Loftus, author of The Outsider Test for Faith, How to Know Which Religion is True. John, thank you so much for being on today.
Well, thanks for asking me.
To start off, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you decided to write this book?
I'm a former Christian minister and student and teacher in different colleges. I have a few master's degrees. I thought I would just pick them up all along the way. I got a MA, and that wasn't good enough, so I got an MDiv, and there's one more on the way to a PhD, and so I got a Master of Theology, all on my way to getting a PhD, and by the time I got into the PhD studies, I was quite worn out from getting all those master's degrees, that I only lacked a dissertation, basically, and maybe a couple of classes, and proficiency in two other languages. I was already proficient in Greek and Hebrew, but they wanted me to be proficient in French and German, too. So I was just lacking a little bit to get the PhD, and I just got completely worn out. So I have some degrees behind me, and, you know, in the ministry, about 14 years in the Church of Christ. It's the Campbellite version of the Christian Church. There's three different versions of it. So one is a non-instrumental, that wasn't us. One's called the Conservative Centrists, that was us. And then there are the Liberal Disciples of Christ. Those are the bad guys, you see.
Uh-huh.
And, taught ethics and philosophy, Western Lit, and some apologetics classes for Great Lakes Christian College and Lincoln Christian University. And, you know, it just seemed to me that the more I knew and the more I experienced life, the less I could believe. It doesn't always happen that way to everybody, but it did with me.
That must have been pretty convenient for a religious minister to figure that out.
Well, it was hard. I mean, it was gut-wrenching. I would spend nights, walking, a little subdivision, and, praying, thinking, and talking. Excuse me. And, it was just gut-wrenching. Everything I'd put, my time into for, 20 years, 25 years or something like that, given my early Christian conversion at about the age of 17 or so, and then about 18, and, my upbringing in the Catholic Church, that, that all of a sudden it'd be wrong.
So it must have been a really hard time for you.
Yeah, it was gut-wrenching. It's very hard to realize after all of your studies and all of your plans. I mean, I was going to change the world, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I just realized that the world changed me, I guess, my studies did. So that's a little bit about my background. I, mm-hmm. In one way, I have spent now approximately 40 years on a delusion. First, you know, as a student, as a believer, and as a minister and an educator, and now as a debunker. And you know, I'm still spending my time on this delusion, and it's maddening. You know, people say, why don't you just walk away from it? You know, and I tried for 6 years. I just kind of ignored everything and just got on with life. And you know, I got too much information, and you know, if everybody walked away from the faith and just went on to, you know, make some money and raise families, and you know, not that you can't do that too, but just if you focused on that, then those of us who have left the faith, you know, we have a lot of information to share, and it'd be wasting that. It'd be wasting what we know.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I spent 40 years on a delusion, and I figure it's time to pay it back.
Yeah, get other people to spend a little bit less time on that.
Yeah, it's I want to give this delusion the trashing it deserves for you know, basically quote unquote wasting 40 years of my life, the only one I'll ever have. So
yeah.
You know, and there's a little bit of frustration, you know, sometimes in me because of that. I mean, I kind of wonder sometimes, well, if it weren't for this delusion, you know, that I wasted my, well, quote unquote, I always say quote unquote wasting, is,
yes.
You know, what could I have done? But here I am, this is my lot in life. And, you know, that's just what, you know, I've chosen to do. And, you know, I'm delighted that, you know, what I say, what I write helps people out of this delusion. The earlier, the better, so that they can get on with their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because I feel a bit like when I was younger, I was quite religious as well. I mean, I'm only 31, but I was quite religious too. And then sort of when I hit my 20s, I started to really doubt. And a lot of the doubt came from reading, you know, people like you. I mean, I think that you probably wrote a little bit after that time, but, you know, it is really a helpful thing to read other people's work, especially as a young person, because you kind of see how, you know, you don't want to spend your whole life trying to go down this path that, you know, ultimately you're not going to be able to reconcile those doubts.
Right.
So, appreciate that. I appreciate people like you who do come out and tell their story, because it's not easy.
And everybody has their part to play. I mean, your podcasts, you know, are helping change people's minds too. You know, you never know. I mean, I'm sure you get some thanks from people. I you know, it's just everybody has a part to play, and the internet is really a major source of information for believers. You know, it's funny. You know, I have a blog called Debunking Christianity, and I've got some posts on there. You know, and some of them are titled provocatively, like this one: "Was Jesus born in Bethlehem?" And so, you know, can you imagine an innocent, oh, I don't know, teenager going online, and he types in that question, and he lands on my site, you see? It happens all the time. And sometimes,
uh-huh.
You know, and sometimes immediately their gut reaction is, this guy must be wrong because, well, the Bible's right, see? But
right.
The more they read, you know, the more they just can't avoid us, like they could in generations past, that we're here. We're here to stay.
Yeah. Yeah, the internet does play a large part in that, for sure. It's a lot easier to see differing viewpoints. So what is the outsider test for faith?
Well, the outsider test for faith, you know, came up in online discussions. One Christian apologist was saying to me that, you know, you can't really understand the truth of Christianity because you're not an insider. You know, you just can't understand the spiritual truths of God because of that. And, well, you know, I was an insider one time, but, you know, they like to say that, you know, since you're not now, you can't understand the spiritual truths of God. And so I got to thinking, well, you know, you're right. I mean, in one sense, I'm not an insider, and it takes an insider to believe. And so I got to thinking about how most Christians will treat those other religions that they reject as outsiders, because after all, they don't have faith in you know, Islam. They don't have faith in Mormonism. They don't have faith in Scientology. And so what would it take to convince an outsider to accept one of those religions? And how did we become insiders in the first place? Those questions ruminated in my mind, and I thought to myself, well, you know what? That's the only way to properly, you know, investigate whether your own faith is true, and that is whether or not it can test if it can pass the test of being an outsider, you know, and that is to critically examine your own inherited faith with the same level of skepticism you use when you treat those other faiths that you reject. Now, atheists have been saying that for generations. Over the course of years, I've developed the tests and argued for it, and you know, I've got a massive amount of Christians who would debate it, so then I could come up with additional, you know, counter arguments to it. And this book is just the result of that conversation.
Right. Yeah. You say that the OTF is actually a solution to the problem of religious diversity. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, it's obvious we have religious diversity. It's spread out all over the globe in separate different geographical locations. You know, I've got a little map in the back of my book. It's black and white, but it still communicates the point that, you know, if you were born, you know, in a Muslim country, you know, you would be a Muslim. At least, you know, it depends on the regime in place. You know, you certainly wouldn't want to talk against, you know, the Muslim faith. And that, you know, that in itself can be a problem, but since Islam is growing in democratic countries like in Europe right now exponentially, you know, you can see how that, you know, the very fact that they, you know, are mandated by law to accept Islam isn't really the, you know, a defeater to the outsider test of faith, and I argue about that in the book, but since people are born into different religions, I mean, you know, in China, you'd likely be an Eastern religion, one of the Eastern religions. You know, you might even believe that some guru is God. If you were born and raised in India, you know, you might think you know, Hinduism is the correct religion. So you're born into religions, and you know, and people who are born into these religions all think that their religions are, you know, true and certain, and some of them will even fly planes into buildings. You know, they're so certain that they're true. So with this problem we have of so many insiders born into religions based on, you know, what their mama taught them on their knee, well, then how can we properly evaluate the religion we're born into? You know, how can we solve this problem, the problem of religious diversity? How can we find a method that would help us all learn the truth, you know, about which religion is true, if there is one? And, you know, I go through in the book, and I mentioned six different kinds of tests that people have proposed, and, you know, none of them make any sense, and some of them are bad, really bad, that the only way, that's my argument, that the only way to know which religion is true, if there is one, is by treating your own religion with the same level of skepticism that you do, you know, the other ones that you reject. And so I think that if there's any test, any way to solve the problem of religious diversity is with the outsider test for faith. Ta-da! Bada-bing, bada-boom.
And how have people reacted to that? Like, how do Christians react when you present that idea to them?
Well, some of them would say, you know, without thinking, they would say, yeah, my faith passes the outsider test of faith. Ta-da! It's a mere assertion. It's a mere assertion. You know, they will say that. They will say that. But as soon as they say that, as soon as they say, my faith passes the test of the outsider test, then we can have a real robust debate at that point. At that point, then, they've acknowledged, you know, at least verbally only, that they should test their own faith with the same level of skepticism, you know, they test other religions by. And so no more punting to faith when it comes to insoluble problems like how some guy could be 100% God and 100% man with nothing left over, Jesus, you see. No more punting to, you know, that, you know, you really want to have some answers to that question. You know, how is that possible? Let's discuss that reasonably, you see. No more quoting the Bible, see, because at that point you don't know whether the Bible is true or not, because as an outsider, you're investigating first and foremost whether the Bible is true, you see. And so the debate can really begin once they say flippantly that my faith passes that test, and at that point again the debate can begin. That's one right. One type of answer.
It's interesting because it kind of sounds like you're asking them essentially to leave all assumptions behind and maybe even recognize that they have assumptions, because I think a lot of people to begin with the assumption that, well, there is a God, so everything is going to fit into that. And your test is sort of saying, well, assume, just pretend for a second that you don't believe this, and then try to look at that critically.
Right. It's really hard to do that. It will throw up all kinds of smoke. Yeah. It will throw up all kinds of smoke screens. Like, I can't set aside all of my assumptions. I mean, I was born in a particular culture, and it's just psychologically impossible to, put all assumptions, off the table. And I agree. I mean, when it comes to worldviews, I mean, no one's asking them to, set aside your entire worldview. I'm only talking about one specific plank in your set of beliefs, and that is, your religious beliefs. And I'm only asking them to set aside the assumptions as much as possible. And I do recognize it's, it can be psychologically impossible for some believers who just simply can't do that. But to set aside their presumption that the Bible's true, set aside the presumption that Jesus died for your sins, and examine all those sorts of things, with the same level, of skepticism they use when they examine other religions. Just a minor set of religious beliefs, is all that it asks. So that's a smokescreen, you see, to keep them from, really examining their faith. I think some of them, well, many of them, maybe most of them, don't really want to know whether their religion is true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on that point, what do you say to people who say they don't care if their religion is true? Because there are a lot of people who say that, right?
Yeah, I know some personal family members of mine that would have told me, I really don't have the time to investigate this, or I just prefer to believe what I do, or don't confuse me with the facts. And one said, I prefer to believe, and even if it's ignorant, I just prefer to believe because it makes me happy. Well, those are not really good reasons for examining one's faith, but yeah, people will do that, and I can't help some people, any of them.
Yeah.
They just can't be helped.
It's interesting. A lot of people say, well, it's just symbolic. The resurrection was symbolic. But it's bizarre because that is not really what is taught. If you go to, whatever Sunday school or whatever it is. I mean, I imagine in seminary they didn't teach you, well, maybe Jesus didn't resurrect, but it's symbolic.
Yeah, that would be the liberal answer to that question, since liberals can't make sense of someone who would die and then be given a different body, and they certainly can't say it's the same body. Certainly, if those bodies are eaten by sharks or maggots, or just think of all the bodies that have been buried throughout the entire existence on Earth. Those bodies have rotted away and turned to weeds by now. Well, then how can there be a resurrection for these bodies? They no longer exist. And if the bodies are now inside the stomachs of maggots or wolves or sharks, they're now part of, for instance, they would actually be one and the same with a shark body, you see. So how can this body be resurrected? So then they say things like, the resurrection is symbolic. Well, in one sense, they're being more reasonable than other Christians. I have to grant them that. But what they're doing, what they're simply doing, is they're just simply reinventing their faith in every generation to make it, more sense, rather than asking themselves, well, let's look at the original basis of that, belief, and what was it originally believed, and, critically examining that and saying, well, then why do I need to reinvent something that's been shown false? I mean, I've produced a number of books. One of them is called The End of Christianity, and in that book, Jaakko Gerke writes a chapter called Can God exist if Yahweh doesn't? And he goes through, you know, some of the things that are said in the Bible about Yahweh. You know, he was the head of a pantheon of gods, and he was sired by Elion, the chief, you know, god at one time, but then later superseded him, and he had sons, which means he had a wife. You know, you don't have sons without a wife. So this Yahweh had a wife and sons, and the wife was edited out. We know her to be the queen of heaven. If you look it up in the Bible, that's what they edited. Asherah is her name. And so we know this is about Yahweh, and yet no one believes in Yahweh, so then why should we believe in God? And it's a beautiful chapter. I love it. And so, you know, rather than reinvent God in every generation like Christians did, you know, and then Anselm did in the 11th century, rather than keep reinventing this notion of God into a monotheistic God who, you know, creator of all and omniscient and omnibenevolent. Well, we know this God is not omnibenevolent because we see him creating all kinds of disasters, you know, and things in the Bible. Rather than reinventing this stuff like the resurrection is just symbolic, why don't we just acknowledge that the original source for our beliefs in the Bible is faulty and just abandon it. That's the only consistent thing to do.
Right, right. And what about those people who say that we should be just as skeptical of skepticism?
I don't know if you can allow this word online, but bullshit. I mean,
you can allow anything online.
I mean, that's just again, bullshit. You know, how can you actually be skeptical of skepticism? You know, I ask these Christians who say that, are you skeptical of your skeptical conclusions that Scientology is wrong? I mean, you know, think of the absurdity of being skeptical of your skepticism that Scientology is wrong. I mean, a double negative or a double, using that word twice in the same sentence negates it. So basically you'd be saying, well, why don't you have faith in Scientology?
Yeah.
Well, you know, well, how do I judge whether I should have faith in Scientology? Well, you should do it by means of skepticism. And the skepticism involved would be to say, you know, show me the evidence. Show me some reasons. You know, see if it passes intellectual muster. You know, give me the sufficient evidence, sufficient objective evidence. Our minds are so woefully inadequate when it comes to evaluating truth claims when, you know, when we have a need to believe that the only way to test whether or not these truth claims are in fact true is sufficient objective evidence. And they'll even debate that. They'll even say, well, why should I need sufficient objective evidence for my faith? Well, again, bullshit. It's, you know, it's crazy. I mean, the kinds of things that they will say in response, I mean, if nothing else, they should show to any reasonable person that they are not being reasonable. I mean, who in any other area of learning would say, well, you know, we don't need sufficient objective evidence? It's the mind of the deluded person run amok. It's cognitive bias. I mean, if you don't want sufficient objective evidence for what you believe, then go away, you know, and have a nice day. I mean, I can't help you. You can't be helped.
Yeah. Well, what about people that see religion as a sort of, because I actually heard this the other day from someone, that religion is like love. It's a subjective experience, and that, therefore, it's not in the realm of objectivity.
Yeah, I mean, that's reducing religion to such a low common denominator that a subjective experience that, you know, it can be safely, be disregarded. You know, I mean, I could respond to that claim, well, I have a subjective experience that says that your subjective experience is wrong. Or I could say, with so many different people claiming so many contradictory claims based on subjective, you know, experiences, how can you really claim to know that your subjective experience is real? You know, be honest about that and come to terms with the fact that subjective personal experiences are only evidence of subjective personal experiences. And the content involved in those subjective experiences, that is, you know, what did you learn from that euphoric feeling, you know, vary even by the same groups of people who claim to have them. Like Christians, for instance, they'll say, well, I have, you know, an experience with God. Well, tell me about this God. Well, they'll, you know, go on and on about God. Tell me about the Bible. Okay, they'll go on and on. Tell me about the resurrection, since we mentioned that earlier. Some of those people who claim to have the same subjective experience will say, well, the resurrection is symbolic, like we mentioned earlier. And others will say from that same subjective experience that the resurrection was physical. Well, then how can we actually know that this subjective, you know, personal experience has any informational content to it? Some will say, based on that subjective experience, that the Bible is literally true in every, you know, every sentence. And others will say, well, there's metaphor here, there's hyperbole there. So these subjective experiences, basically, once one has them, merely confirm what they already believed in the content of that experience. So really, you know, yeah, we have subjective experiences. That's true. I might have a hallucination. I might have a dream. I might see a mirage. What we need to do is we need to test those subjective experiences with sufficient objective evidence. You know, and if you don't want to do that, again, you can't be helped.
Right. You say that actually religious views are different from political views, because I think a lot of people think that they're kind of the same thing, that you shouldn't really criticize either or talk about either. But you say that's actually quite different. What is the difference between those two?
Well, yes, we need to have politics. You know, we just absolutely need, you know, agreed upon rules of behavior, and that would be morality, of course, and then you know, the politics based on it. You know, that which side of the street are we going to drive? You know, and in some countries it's, you know, on the left, and in America it's on the right. Well, we have to have that. We can't have a haphazard rule there. We have to have a rule. We have to have politics. And it doesn't just go with, you know, on which side of the road you drive on, but it also has to do with how we're going to spend money and how much we're going to tax people and where are we going to build this highway and where we're going to, what kind of laws are we going to use on the off the coasts, you know, of America to housing laws, you know, I mean, you know, how are we going to run our government? We have to have them, and every country will have them. Because whenever you put two people together, you're going to have rules of behavior, you know, including proper etiquette. We just have to have them. So we're going to have them whether we like them or not. We're going to have them whether they can be justified or not. We're going to have them. They're necessary. Now, when it comes, there's evidence that if everybody drives on one side of the road, we'll have fewer deaths. So there's evidence that shows that having these rules are beneficial, you know, to human flourishing and survival. But when it comes to religion, we don't need them. I mean, that's the argument. I mean, we don't need them. In fact, you know, in many ways, they can be harmful. And I'm in the process of editing a new book called Christianity is Not Great, based on Hitchens' book, God is Not Great, where I've gathered some scholars who are going to, you know, dismantle some of the harms that Christianity has caused and is causing in today's world. Harriet Hall has agreed to write a chapter on faith-based healing. You know, I mean, the very fact that, you know, some people don't take their kids to hospitals but rely on, you know, faith, you know, faith miracles and stuff like that, it has killed kids, you see. So religion is different than politics and morality because you don't need them. They actually cause damage, and you know, there's no evidence that one set of rules or one set of beliefs is better or more beneficial to human flourishing. Now, if a religion does happen to come up with something that you know, helps human flourishing, and it has, then that's not based on the religion itself, is what I argue. It's based on, you know, just basically, you know, we human beings. I mean, religions do meet some needs. And as it meets needs, the reason why it meets needs is because that it has some reasonable solutions to human problems unrelated to the faith of the religion itself. Mm-hmm. So, they're different. And one's not needed, one's harmful, and the other one is necessary. And there's evidence that it creates human flourishing.
Mm-hmm. You actually argue that the more that believers are educated in their faith, I assume you mean, the more they engage in theology and that kind of thing, the more diluted they tend to be. Is that something to notice from personal experience? Or?
Yeah. I recently co-wrote a book with Randall Rouser, Dr. Randall Rouser. He teaches in Taylor Seminary in Edmonton, Canada, and I was up there 3 or 4 weeks ago and debated him on 3 successive nights. He is, Exhibit A. I mean, he's extremely educated in his faith, and he responds with the idea that his faith is still possible despite any of my arguments, as if all he has to do is poke a pinprick of doubt in one of my arguments, and says, "Well, see, there's room for my Trinitarian, incarnational, atoning, resurrecting, returning Jesus faith." And he tries to slip that in through the cracks at every point along the way. Yeah, he's definitely, and not just him. The more educated they are, then the more they can defend unintelligent beliefs. Now, that's not always the case. Of course, you can mention people like Hector Avalos and Bart Ehrman, and a lot of us who, Robert Price, myself, with more and more information also comes doubt. But until that critical turning point comes where the scholar sees something differently or decides to put on new eyes or to see the evidence, until that happens, then yes, they can be more deluded, not less. And the problem with that, and it's annoying to me, Annie, is that these scholars who are still in the deluded phase will write reviews of our books as if they never even read it in the first place, because they don't have the eyes to even understand what the arguments are. Randall Rouser wrote a review of Stephen Law's book, Believing Bullshit. It's a really good book. And Randall Rouser wrote a review of that. Stephen Law responded by saying, "Hey, this is a shoddy review of my book." And he says, "You don't even understand my arguments." He says, "I'll spend a little time refuting what you said, but I don't really plan to spend much more time given that I've got more important things to do." And I've experienced this. So then the believing masses of people who are reading Randall Rouser, they will say things like, "Well, see, I don't need to read Stephen Law's book now because Randall Rouser just trashed him." Norman Geisler did the same thing with me. He's a prolific Christian apologist. He's written over 60 books, and he reviewed my book. And, it was basically a hatchet job by a scholar. And I read his review, and I said to myself, I shook my head, and I said, "Well, he's responding to my arguments as if he never even read them." I mean, it's really maddening. So the believing masses in the pews who read people like, Geisler and Randall Rouser and, the others that are out there, they don't actually read our work. Mm-hmm. They read these deluded scholars' responses to our work. If they go into a Christian bookstore, they're more likely than anything to simply look for an apologetics book that answers us rather than read what we say ourselves. And these scholars, being more deluded, nearly confirm to the believing masses that their faith is true without actually reading what we say, because these scholars are more deluded. It's maddening. It's maddening.
Right. Yeah, I kind of wonder, what is it that is taught in theology? Like, when you're in the seminary and so forth, they teach you, the history of your religion and the Bible and so forth, but is there any critical eye at all? And if there is it sort of brushed aside? How does that work?
Well, in my case, you know, in probably about 12, 13 years of education, I'm trying to think if we actually brought in a skeptical scholar's book. No, none were required. No skeptical book was required. We would read mainly Christian voices, and that's about it. Now, we would be asked to write some things, and we'd have to open the pages at least a little bit of a skeptical work. Touch the cover of that book, see, and claim you read it. But yeah, it's mainly just simply reading each other's Christian works, you know, for the most part, or maybe some kind of a little left. That was my experience.
Already believe.
Yeah, and these works are written by these scholars who I call more deluded. So it's really reinforcing. It just simply reinforces itself upon the Christian educator. Now some, you know, that was, again, that's my experience. I mean, I think that other seminaries and colleges do differently. Dan Lambert, when he was teaching at John Brown University, he actually brought my book, Why I Became an Atheist, into his classroom, and it was required reading. So, you know, I was, you know, flattered by that. Richard Knopp at Lincoln Christian University uses that same book in his seminary classes. So, you know, I mean, and that's to be applauded. It's being honest. So there's some various, you know, responses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why you argue at some point that in your book that trust is not the same thing as faith, and that religious people quite often confuse the two.
Yeah, I argue in the last chapter of the book. Is that what you're referring to, the last chapter?
Yeah.
So we're at the end of the interview already? We're at the last chapter. We made it to the last chapter.
Go on.
Yeah.
Not in order, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's... you know, it is the last chapter because it's also a controversial one, and I know that. So, you know, that's unrelated to the test itself. I mean, a Christian could say, well, okay, I can agree with the need for testing my faith, you know, like John writes, but I don't agree with the last chapter. But if they don't agree with the last chapter, then that says nothing at all about the test itself, because I've already defended it. But in the last chapter, I talk about why faith is basically an irrational leap over the probabilities. It's a cognitive bias. It ought to be listed on Wikipedia as a cognitive bias. I really think so, because you don't settle anything by faith. I mean, I've had a lot of conversations with believers, and I'll ask some reasonable questions about this or that. And they'll say, but John, you just got to have faith.
Uh-huh.
As if it's a virtue, you see.
Right.
It's a virtue. And I am more virtuous than you because I can muster up the faith to believe, you see. You can't, you know, or something like that. Well, faith can't settle anything. I mean, all you got to do is talk to the people around the world who would make that same response to reasonable questions for sufficient evidence. And when they are stumped or something like that, if they respond, but John, you got to have faith. Well, that echoes mm-hmm. just what the Christians say. You just got to have faith. Well, faith is not a virtue at all. It can be used to defend anything. You know, if faith is a virtue, then anything can be believed, or anything can be denied. I mean, if you don't need sufficient objective evidence for something, then... you know, go to La La Land.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Well, say, for example, that you know, that atheists do believe things in the sense that we believe in science, right? Some people equate that to being similar to believing in religion, or that we believe our mothers when they tell us something. But that is not the same, so...
No, because...
How would you react?
Yeah, because all of those things And let me just focus on one of them, love. I mean, they talk about love. How do you know, how do you know that, somebody loves you? You know, I mean, you believe someone loves you, don't you? Well, I believe that God loves me, like a parallel case.
Right.
Well, I can believe someone loves me. Take my mother, for instance. I don't believe it. I know it. I mean, she showed me all kinds of, all through my life. That she loves me, my brothers, likewise. I mean, these are things that we can know based on the probabilities. And no, nothing's certain. I mean, I guess it's always possible. My mom has deceived me for 58 years into thinking that she loves me when she really hates my guts. You know, I mean, I guess that is possible, but it's such a minimal possibility. It doesn't even register on a scale, you see. Because you can test whether someone loves you based on what they do for you, based on what they say to you, based on whether they're talking behind your back, or not. And so you know these sorts of things based on the evidence, you see. And if believers would approach God in the same way as we do when it comes to knowing whether someone loves you or not, then they would have to weigh the instances of evil that take place in their lives. I mean, objectively, and whether there's evidence to even believe in the first place, or the basis for that belief in the Bible itself. And they would say, well, you know what, the probability that this God exists, is minimal, at best, if they were being honest. So you can trust somebody based on the probabilities. In fact, I say it this way. We should think exclusively in terms of the probabilities. And so something either has more or less probability to it. We just don't have English words to distinguish those probabilities when we say things like, I know my mom loves me. Well, if I were to assign a probability value to it, then it would be probably, something like 99.999%. But when it comes to whether or not the sun rises in the morning or will rise in the morning, I can assign the same kind of probability. I go and I talk about that in the book. So all we have to do is assign words like, extremely probable or more probable than not to our words. We just can't do that with the English language. So when we say we know something, you could always respond by saying, well, to what degree do you know that? And then we'd be talking, then we'd have a reasonable discussion. But to say, I believe something like God exists just as much as you believe the sun rises, will rise in the morning, is that word again, bullshit. It's not the same. It's not the same by far.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of your major criticisms is that Christians demand that unbelievers prove that God is impossible before they consider it to be improbable.
Yeah, it really is. That I was talking about Randall Rausser earlier. I mean, he's demanding that I prove that his faith is impossible. And, I just say that's an impossible standard of proof. And that's a deluded mind again. I think a couple of reasons why they do that is because they have a need to believe. And so if they can find a little pinprick of doubt, then they can just walk right through that with their incarnational Trinitarian faith, But I think that the notion of hell almost requires it, because if I could be wrong and I leave the faith, then I could, be tortured for eternity. So because of that belief and because of something I call the omniscience escape clause, that, an omniscient God can solve any problem, like you ask, well, how did Jesus' death on the cross, pay for my sins? There's really no reasonable answer to that question. But if they respond by saying, well, God knows why, God knows why it was, necessary, that's called the omniscience escape clause, and, it solves all problems. Since that, they...
It's all God's plan.
What's that? Yeah, God has a plan.
Yeah, God has a plan.
So since you have those twin beliefs of hell and the omniscience escape clause, then that's what they're actually doing. They're asking me to prove their faith is false before they will come to think it's improbable, which is reversing the standards of proof.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's almost like a trial where if you can argue that there's reasonable doubt, then that means means God exists. That's the logical conclusion.
Right.
Well, not just God, but their God. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Coming back to the resurrection, since that's a topic that I find interesting, you have an interesting view of that. You say at one point that all it requires is one liar for Jesus.
Yep. I fleshed that argument out in a whole chapter for why I became an atheist, the revised version. And it's, you know, if we're talking about whether or not a body was reanimated 3 days after being crucified and walked around, you know, Jerusalem and convinced people that a miracle had occurred, if we're comparing that hypothesis with the one that perhaps the Gospel of Mark invented, the empty tomb sequence, if we're comparing those two hypotheses, then the idea that Mark created the empty tomb scene at the end of his Gospel wins hands down. I mean, there are a lot of, that is the first liar for Jesus, you know. All it takes is one little Gospel disseminated through largely illiterate people who would possibly believe anything based on a vision. You know, we know that Paul was a visionary. He saw visions, you know, here and there. He even claims that the Damascus Road conversion was based on a vision to Festus. You know, he says, why should I be disobedient to this vision I've had? So he says Damascus Road experience was a vision. So with people who believe that visions are real and they communicate divine truth, then Mark might have had a vision. I mean, the author of Mark might have had a vision. And, hey, this solves the problem of, you know, why Jesus isn't walking, you know, among us. I mean, you know, the empty tomb, you know, sequence solves that. I mean, why Jesus isn't, you know, still dead? I mean, why isn't he still somewhere? Well, because we have the evidence of the empty tomb. And, you know, this solves that problem. And, you know, based on the idea of the empty tomb, you see how many Christian apologists use that in today's world to argue that this is evidence that Jesus arose from the dead, and it could be based on nothing more than a lie. And that, you know, there's a lot of things that took place and take place every day that are extremely rare. And I point to Oprah Winfrey's discovery that she has a half-sister late in life. What are the odds of that? Well, extremely, extremely rare. I mean, what are the odds that I might have a twin brother, you know, that I haven't known before, my mom never told me about? Well, extremely, extremely rare. But it wasn't a miracle, you see. These extremely rare types of events happen. And so even though it might seem unlikely that Mark would create the empty tomb sequence, it's far more likely that that could have been the case rather than that a miracle took place, by far.
Yeah. So if people want to read your book, if they're interested, where should they go? Is it on Amazon? Is it in most bookstores?
Yeah, it's in bookstores. It's on Amazon. Yep. You can check out my blog, debunkingchristianity.blogspot.com, and there are links to all my books. Yep. Read them. Comment on them. Pass them out.
All right. Thank you so much for the very interesting conversation, John.
Well, thanks, Annie. Thanks for calling.
You have been listening to an interview with John W. Loftus, author of The Outsider Test for Faith, How to Know Which Religion is True. This is your hostess, Annie Sipukaya. Thank you for listening to New Books in Secularism.